Sure. Good evening. Thank you very much for joining us this evening to discuss the communications bill. We're in the era of communication, so I hope that everyone will switch off their mobile phones before we begin. My name's James Harding. I'm the media editor of the Financial Times. And the first thing I'd like to say is people should brush their teeth more and stop eating sweet things. Because I spent 2.5 hours in the dentist chair this afternoon getting root canal work done. And I say this as a piece of advice and also an explanation for the fact that if the long words escape me, that's either because they're too technical or the anesthetic is still wearing off, so I hope you'll forgive me for that. Now, this session, which has been brought together by the LSE, by Channel 4 and BT, was called, at least when it sent to me, a first response to the draft proposals of the communications bill. And that sounded to me rather timid, and that we were in for a bunch of hesitant suggestions gingerly put. I'm glad to say that with this panel, there is little likelihood of that. A group of people with more hefty experience and more forthright opinions, you'd be hard put to find. Here this evening, we have Sir Christopher Bland, well known to listeners of Radio 4 as a fly fisherman, also the chairman of BT and previously the chairman of the Board of Governors, in his time a regulator, his time a very successful commercial TV operator. We have Professor Robin Mansell, who is here from, well, is at home really, is a professor at the LSE. I was looking at her collection of her books and the stuff on the LSE website this afternoon, and I see, reassuringly for some of our guests in the audience, people like Patricia Hodson and Richard Hooper, that Professor Mansell looks at the effectiveness of regulators, but more worryingly at also their failures. So I'm looking forward to our comments. Phil Riley, who's played a big and very important part in my life, he launched Heart FM in the West Midlands and London, is now the chief executive of Chrysalis Radio, and we're looking forward to getting some clarification on what the comms bill is planning for the radio sector. And, of course, Barry Cox, the deputy chairman of Channel 4, someone whom I was looking through our clippings, and it seemed as though certain papers had got into the habit of referring to Barry Cox as the influential Barry Cox. Here he is, the influential Barry Cox. Now, the plan is that each of our panelists will say a few words to begin with, setting out their thoughts on the communications bill. My job is quite simply to watch the clock. After that, I've been asked to suggest a few prodding questions following up on some of the things that they suggest. But most importantly, then, we will open the discussion to the floor. I hope we'll get a lot of thoughtful, provocative, and most of all, concise questions and comments from the floor. Before that, of course, I've been asked just to sort of set the scene and give a short introduction to the bill. This is a rather tricky thing to do, given that some of the people who drafted it are here, and they may not enjoy the editing process. I know that I don't always enjoy it. The headlines, of course, by now are known to everyone. It was a wonderful bill. It was this great liberalizing bill. It went much further than everyone expected. The Americans were more or less invited to come in and own our radio stations, our television stations, I'm sorry, the prohibition on non-European ownership of terrestrial broadcasters was lifted. The radio industry, which seemed to have been paralyzed by so many rules and regulations, was opened up for a new buying frenzy. ITV and Channel 5 could be owned by the same person. The old Murdoch rule seemed to have been lifted. Newspaper proprietors were going to get a greater room for maneuver. And at the same time, the government was getting rid of the alphabet soup of regulators. We were going to have one streamlined, simple, sensible regulator, Ofcom. This is charged with the promotion of competition. It's charged with the optimal use of spectrum, looking after the optimal use of spectrum, and the protection of content and quality and diversity. And at the same time, of course, it's also being asked to champion the government's love of light-touch regulation. Now, the commentators, the FT included, has generally cheered this bill. We thought to ourselves that the government and the politicians involved had learnt the lesson by now that their meddling was not greatly appreciated, over-regulation had hampered the industry, and the media, the broadcasting industry in particular, was now being treated more like any other business. Of course, investment bankers and lawyers were thrilled. It may not be a huge constituency, but an influential one nonetheless. And generally, people have been very supportive of the bill. However, there are many questions now which, on closer scrutiny of the bill, seem either unanswered or not really very clearly thought of. And that's what we're here to discuss this evening. I think the biggest, or at least from our point of view, one of the biggest tensions of all is that the UK media industry is now being opened up to foreign ownership. The government is saying it champions light-touch regulation. Well, who is going to protect the interests of audiences, of citizens? There seems to be a tension that the government is inviting between proprietors who are far, far away from the UK and a regulator who is supposed to keep a very close eye and close eye on what they're doing and them on a tight rein. There's some things which simply haven't been addressed at all, or at least largely ignored. 2 years ago, one of the big questions for the drafts of the forthcoming communications bill, you'll remember this has been a long time coming, was internet content regulation on the internet. It just seems to have passed us by now. There are some intellectual inconsistencies, arguably, in the bill. Why is it the case that newspaper proprietors can own Channel 5, but they're not allowed to own ITV? Let's say, by way of example, that you seriously increased the programming budget on Channel 5, and things at ITV continue to go the way they've been going for the last few years. In a couple of years, it's going to be make very little sense, it seems to me, for Channel 3 to be excluded from newspaper proprietors, but Channel 5 to be available to them. There are some curious little quirks in the bill. For example, religious bodies are now going to be allowed to own restricted service licenses. Does that mean we're going to have a bunch of regional televangelists in this country? I'm not sure that's been addressed. But perhaps one of the biggest and most interesting holes in the bill, or not holes, sort of areas of light coverage in the bill, has been the telecom sector in general. This has been one of the most surprising things, is how little weight perhaps we in the media have paid to the way in which it's been covered. But the bill itself has seemed to be very much focused on the broadcasting industry. And one of the first issues I hope we'll address this evening, when we ask Sir Christopher to speak in 1 minute, is to say, will this bill help improve the telecommunications industry and the service that people get as customers in this country in the telecom sector? Would we have had the unbundling problems? Would we have had the broadband problems? Would we have had the failure to deliver DSL in this country had we had this comms bill? Would that do anything to improve the kind of telecoms environment we live and operate in? There are many questions like this I'm sure that you all have. I hope you will be ready and willing to ask questions at the end of the comments from panellists. First, though, I turn over to Sir Christopher Bland, the chairman of BT. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that by the time this bill becomes an act, 2.5 hours of root canal work will seem positively pleasurable. Never mind. This is, as James has pointed out, this is the most important telecoms legislation since BT was privatised under the Act 18 years ago. And yet, predictably, media coverage of the bill has been dominated by media ownership. Rupert Murdoch may not completely monopolise the media industry, but he's certainly monopolised the media headlines when the bill was published. And yet, telecoms is far too important to be taken for granted in this debate. It's a key enabling technology, it's a driver of economic success, it promotes educational excellence and many other public policy objectives, for example, in the fields of health and of local government. Clear evidence exists from the USA that, rightly applied, information and communications technology can have a profound effect on productivity and economic growth. So our industry, our part of the bill, deserves more than a passing nod. how do we respond to the provisions in the bill at the moment? The overall thrust of the bill seems to BT pretty good. The creation of a single regulator is long overdue. Telecoms and broadcasting are near neighbours, if not exactly flatmates, and regulation increasingly must take account of one as well as the other. In particular, we are pleased to see appeals on merit, which is something we've been campaigning on for years. We welcome the fact that Ofcom will have real-world objectives and recognises the need for trade-off between competition and consumer interest. What do I mean by that? Well, a good example, I think, is the 192 rules that have applied this week, where on the one hand, competition suggests that BT shouldn't have a monopoly of the single 192 number that we all know and love, and on the other hand, the consumer plainly, at least for a while, is going to be confused by having to choose amongst 26-figure alternatives. It's those sorts of trade-offs that Ofcom is going to have to make. There's a lot of good news in the bill. We think the drafting team has listened hard, and that doesn't mean that BT thinks that we'll have other than a pretty robust relationship with Ofcom. But we'd like to see it work effectively, and my comments are directed now towards that end. First of all, I think it's vital that Ofcom has a consumer focus. We think that the consumer panel's independence should be reinforced, that it should be appointed directly by the Secretary of State, not by Ofcom, with the Secretary of State's blessing. It needs its own budget and support staff. Secondly, Ofcom is charged with delivering light-touch regulation, but that needs to be quite specific if it's going to be effective. We think that Ofcom should have an anti-gold-plating duty, and I speak as a former regulator, as a deputy chairman of the IBA, and I'm afraid to say I was a gold plater along with the rest of them. That's what regulators do. They regulate, and gold plating is in the natural instincts, particularly in the United Kingdom, of all regulatory bodies. We need to implement, in particular, EU directives with minimum burdens on UK industry, and that implementation should be consistent with what happens in the rest of the European Union. Third, we're very keen on the deregulatory reviews that are suggested in the bill. But just to have regard to those reviews is the equivalent of resolutions to take more exercise, to eat more salad, drink less beer, and read improving books. And we think that Ofcom needs very specifically to be required to remove rules that are no longer needed. Fourth, there's more to making Ofcom work than just passing laws. Ofcom's size and significance warrant scrutiny by a parliamentary select committee, even though many of us have reservations about that process. It's better than no scrutiny at all. Finally, the bill has to be robust and future-proof. We're not going to see an end to sector-specific regulation, but we do need a simplification of the current framework and a drive for deregulation wherever there is clear evidence that competition is working and that competitive markets exist. If the bill does this, it'll serve us all well, both in terms of giving us a stimulus to economic growth and a vibrant and plural media sector.
Thank you very much. I turn now to Barry Cox. As many of you will have seen in the papers, Channel 4 has painted itself as the silent victim of this bill. I'm interested to hear what the Deputy Chairman of Channel 4 has to say.
Okay, thank you. Overall, I think the draft bill delivers on the government's aspirations to create the right kind of regulatory framework for the converging worlds of telecoms, media and information technology. And a particularly important feature, which I welcome, is the way it allows for dynamic change and expects the regulator and the regulations to adjust rapidly to events. Tonight, though, I want to speak briefly about one particular aspect, the relationship between the vision of public service broadcasting contained in the bill and the substantial reforms it proposes to the current media ownership regulations. The draft bill leaves two major pillars of the broadcasting architecture largely unchanged, that's the BBC and Sky. We will have to wait for several weeks to see whether the amendments to the BBC agreement affect this judgment, though I doubt that they will. And we'll have to wait even longer to find out how Ofcom interprets its competition powers and obligations in respect to Sky. But for the moment, these two titans have little to complain about. However, the bill's provisions, if carried through, will, I think, have a major impact on the third pillar, the commercial public service broadcasters. Looking at ITV and Channel 5, and purely on their terms, I think the new policy is coherent. The cordon sanitaire of ownership regulations which surrounds them has been largely withdrawn. At the same time, there's a realistic view of what commercial broadcasters will be able to achieve in respect of public service obligations over the next decade. Essentially, these obligations will be confined to a substantial volume of original production and to a well-financed quality news service, together, in ITV's case, with regional commitments. I think this both recognises commercial reality and goes with the grain of what can be reasonably enforced by the regulator. As James pointed out in his introduction, the differentiation between channels 3 and 5 in respect of cross-media rules perhaps lacks intellectual logic, but it is a clever political compromise and allows for the possibility of between 1 and 3 commercial terrestrial broadcasters. However, I regret to say I do not think the same coherence is evident in the vision for Channel 4. And indeed, the bill's provisions are, in our case, in some respects contradictory. On the one hand, there is an entirely sensible revision of Channel 4's remit and an affirmation of its core purpose as a public corporation. Against this, the potentially serious negative consequences of some of the bill's other proposals seem to have escaped its authors. The bill will significantly increase the commercial pressures on Channel 4, pressures which could progressively undermine its ability to do the job that it's required to do. I'll pick out the key ones, the ones that I regard as the key ones anyway. First, BBC 3 with a light public service output. Two, the threat of a spectrum tax. Three, a consolidated ITV, possibly united with Channel 5. And four, a merger of Sky and Channel 5. These last two would result in a significant increase in the commercial power of their respective sales forces. In the case of a merged Sky Channel 5, this would be further enhanced by the opportunity for joint rights purchasing and very powerful cross-promotional opportunities. On top of this, Ofcom might be obliged to load public service obligations that were no longer being met by ITV or Channel 5 onto Channel 4. Of course, it is possible that the BBC governors may successfully impose a serious public service role on BBC Three, that the government will mitigate, if not eliminate, the effect of spectrum pricing on Channel 4 and the BBC, that Ofcom will take a prudent view of the impact of consolidating ITV or of ITV and Channel 5 on the airtime sales market. However, I cannot see Ofcom rejecting a proposed merger of Sky and Channel 5, should that come about, since the bill explicitly permits it, and since the operation of competition law hitherto suggests that the regulators take an excessively narrow view of the relevant markets in such circumstances. And for this reason, I very much hope that Parliament will restore the 2020 ownership rule to the ownership of Channel 5. The government rightly proclaims its intention to safeguard the interests of both the consumer and the citizen. I have to say, I seriously doubt whether it's managed this in respect of the longer-term future of Channel 4.
All right, thank you very much. I can turn now to Professor Robin Mansell, who's written about mobilising the information society. You're mobilised.
Thank you, James. We have a kind of a special opportunity to consider this bill because we don't actually have a direct interest in any of the stakeholders. And we've had some discussion about it in our grouping of media at LSE. And I think what I want to start with is to remind us all why it all matters. Yes, it matters for competitiveness and for economic growth, but it also matters for issues of democratic process. And it matters for citizens as much as it matters for consumers. And so the one pillar of infrastructure and service supply and the other pillar of content production matter enormously because in a digital age, the way we live our lives is going to be affected by what goes on in terms of the detail and the broad outlines of this new legislation. There are some things that we particularly welcome because institutional change is a funny thing. You can talk about it, you can speculate about it, you can put words on paper, but then the really interesting thing happens. You get to the negotiation, both of the boundaries of what is possible within the framework of the new bill, and also to the negotiation of the implementation. And there, the devil is in the detail, as we all know. And so the outcomes of the next months of difficult conversations that will go on in many places are in one sense unpredictable, but in another sense, because they matter so much, we have to try to come to grips with whether or not this legislation is, in fact, future-proof. And the couple of points that I want to draw attention to are areas where we believe that perhaps it's not as future-proof as we might like it to be, and there are areas that we feel that really ought to be addressed in the draft legislation. The first one has to do with safeguarding the consumer and citizen interests. Our reading of the draft text suggests that too much emphasis is being given to using the tools of technology, in a sense, to protect citizens' interests. And the reason we reach this conclusion is because the gray area of internet-based services or internet accessed over TV platforms is an area which seems to be excluded with the assumption that self-regulation by the internet industry will actually do the job. And there is a suggestion that self-regulation by the internet industry is actually doing a good job. But we would argue that in the whole range of areas, beyond that which is illegal, where the whole notion of developing media literacy depends on not just enabling consumers to make better choices, but to enable all citizens to be able to critically assess the content and the platforms that are available and to make those choices. And somehow the draft legislation, as we read it, needs to be more tightly pinned down in these areas. We think that it's really infeasible in this era of convergence to make the distinction that seems to be made in the bill that there is a very clear set of services that fall on one side of a boundary that need regulation and a whole lot of others that we don't need to worry about. We would argue that that is not a future-proof way of addressing the new legislation. Another area which we would want to emphasize is the creation of the content board and the consumer panel. In that area, we would want to argue, as has been suggested, that Ofcom needs to have an obligation not just to suggest to those groupings what they might look at and what positions they might wish to discuss, but to allow those organizations to be proactive, to put issues on the agenda and to understand that they will, in fact, be addressed and that there will be transparency in terms of how Ofcom chooses to address those issues. And the last issue I'd like to highlight with regard to communications networks and services is that we're still waiting for the details as to how the draft legislation in its implementation will deal with issues of dispute resolution. Because the fading away of regulation and the light touch approach is very attractive. But I think we all know pragmatically that there are some issues that are just not going to go away. It's in the nature of things. The public service ethos and the commercial ethos will tussle with itself. And there will be new issues as technological change goes on, as there is innovation in services that come along, and they will need some form of dispute resolution. Without knowing how that mechanism will happen, when regulatory intervention will be seen as a positive thing and when it will be seen as something which should be rolled back, it's very difficult to evaluate just how future-proof the draft bill will be. So we would argue that there's a degree of urgency in beginning to specify just how those mechanisms will work. How will the review mechanisms work? Under what circumstances will decisions be taken either to roll back the hand of regulatory intervention or to get tough, because it matters for the reasons I suggested at the outset. It matters for citizens, consumers, as well as the producers. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And finally, Phil Riley's going to talk to us a little about one of the most, well, I guess is going to be one of the more contested areas over the next few months, the small print on radio. Thank you.
Thank you, James. One of the interesting things about radio is, of course, because we don't have Ofcom, we're an extremely fragmented industry. So it's completely impossible for me to sit here and claim to speak on behalf of every radio company in the UK. But what I will try and do is give a broad brush outline of some of the key issues that radio groups seem to feel are ones worth debating in the next 2 or 3 months. I think overall the feeling is very positive for the bill for radio and commercial media in general. And I have to say, I think everything that I'm going to say needs to be set alongside the fact that that at a national level, radio ownership is now going to be subject to purely competition rules is the big win that we have been asking for a long time within commercial radio. And the outdated point system that both the regulator and the industry has laboured under being swept away is without doubt terrific news for the health of the radio industry. So that is the big positive for us, and it's something that we mustn't lose sight of if we then start to go through the rest of the bill asking questions. I think the bill was more deregulatory on ownership and cross-media ownership in general than anybody had possibly expected. And I think that has raised in certain minds the question of whether the specific ongoing local ownership rules for radio are perhaps out of step with the rest of the bill, and it will be something that I think we are expecting to see a debate on as we go through. There is one argument too that the 3+1 rule potentially has an unintended consequence, and the rule is that there must be in well-developed radio markets at least 3 separate owners of radio services, and the unintended consequence of it is that you will have 2 very strong owners and a final licensee struggling on their own to make their way commercially, surrounded by 2 Goliaths. Now, that's one potential outcome of the rule, and I think it's an issue that deserves more debate. And now the government has given the 3+1 rule a green light. I think it is time that we looked at some of the consequences. I think radio in general is concerned about the content board for 2 reasons. Firstly, because it appears that it could become a state within a state within Ofcom. It appears to be given very wide powers, without the specific brief, and I think other people have already talked about giving the content board a better brief from Ofcom as a rule. I think we're worried more, though, because it almost harks back to the IBA days when radio and television were joined at the hip. But most of the rules governing content were driven by the requirements of television rather than radio. The radio authority doesn't have a content board and regulates the output of commercial radio in an entirely different way, I think, to the way in which the output of commercial television is regulated. And I would be worried if we ended up with a content board which moved beyond standard setting to actively manage output in a way that didn't suit the way radio actually operates in this country. More widely, I think, as other people have said, Ofcom has got enormous discretionary powers. I mean, it's fascinating to read the draft bill and for it to say Ofcom will do whatever it wants in a particular set of circumstances. I think that needs to be much more carefully defined. Sir Christopher talked about parliamentary scrutiny. That's one possible area. I think the chairman and the chief executive are going to be critical in this, and one assumes that when they are appointed that we will see some outline thinking on how they intend to take forward those roles. But I am concerned at the lack of detail in terms of the powers that Ofcom have. A couple of minor points. Local content is specifically picked up on with regard to radio. Most local radio stations are immensely proud of the fact that they're local and recognise that being local is one of the things that that allows them to compete in a multimedia world. Whether it's a requirement that on the face of the bill Ofcom has this overarching duty to promote localness, or whether we can't just leave it to the on-off switches of listeners to decide whether a station is local enough, is again a debatable area. And I think there is an issue with regard to the onward sale of licences, where Ofcom is being proposed to be given a duty to redraw formats to maintain the character of a service. Now, the radio industry has long argued that the format is the character of the service, and that in a bill which is proposed to be proprietary neutral, that giving Ofcom the power to rewrite format in the case of a new owner that may want to move a station in a different direction seems illogical. Finally, on the BBC, I'm probably going to say something I think which is strange given the amount of lobbying that's gone on behalf of the commercial sector with regard to the BBC and Ofcom. I think we should put it to one side. I think we should forget trying to bring the BBC any further under the control of Ofcom than it already is. Clearly, there is a battle to be had at the point of charter anew. I think for now what we need to do is concentrate in this consultation period on having a commercial broadcasting industry which is as free as it can be to compete against the BBC on a level playing field, and I think in order to do that we need to concentrate on the commercial sector, not the BBC.
Thank you. Phil, thank you very much. While you gather thoughts for your questions, which I hope will come thick and fast, I had a couple of questions for each panellist in the light of what had been said, I hope we'll have a good session for about 40 minutes after that for questions from the floor, and then rounding things up for us, Chris Smith is going to speak, and he promises pull the whole thing together. I suppose I wanted to start with Sir Christopher. The worrying thing is how happy you seem to be with this bill. I suppose in the last few years, when we cover BT, when we think about BT, it's been thought of as something that has obstructed competition in the British marketplace, particularly when we think about the rollout of DSL. And secondly, as BT is now a little healthier in terms of its debt and its performance, you begin to think of BT once again as a great predator. And I suppose my concern is that there's neither the provisions within this bill to make BT deal with obstruction of something like DSL, prevention of competition in the British marketplace, and at the same time it opens up the whole media landscape to you for you to go shopping.
Well, I can do miserable if you'd like, but I think you've got a very old-fashioned view of the landscape. BT is what it is, and there are trade-offs between encouraging competition and the interests of the consumer, one of which I described earlier. But another good example is local loop unbundling. All the local loops are now unbundled. Nobody wants to get in there and use them. And why? Because this is a big boys' game. And if you look at where ADSL has rolled out successfully in Europe, the most obvious example is Deutsche Telekom, which effectively has a monopoly. Now, I don't think that is the way forward here. We've got a very competitive market. But the idea that ADSL will be accelerated by lots of little companies being encouraged to go into BT exchanges has absolutely failed. And what you want is BT to get on with it, lower its prices, which ironically enough has produced about as much protest as our prices being too high, but never mind about that. You want BT to lower its prices. You want to make sure that BT doesn't behave anti-competitively. You want to make sure that BT doesn't abuse its monopoly powers where those exist. And there is a Competition Act, which is very tough, has draconian penalties, both financial and other penalties on boards that behave anti-competitively. And I think the Competition Act is something that you should rely on to look after that aspect of BT's behaviour. And you'll get, as a result, a better communications market and much, much quicker ADSL rollout as a result.
And what about going shopping? You talked a few months ago about getting into broadcasting.
I didn't talk about getting into broadcasting. The newspapers talked about getting into broadcasting. We're not getting into broadcasting. I say it again. We're not getting into broadcasting. Not. N-O-T. Right. The reason why is very simple. BT doesn't have and won't have, through the ADSL system that it's rolling out, it won't have a broadcast-enabled network. That precludes it from getting into broadcasting. You can't deliver broadcast quality signals satisfactorily down an ADSL network, QED. Second thing is that you don't go shopping when you still owe the banks £13,700 million. Try writing that out on a bit of paper and see how far the zeros go to the east. It's a long way. So the idea that we are predatory and that we are about to go shopping for all these thoroughly desirable media properties is, at least for my foreseeable future, a long way from the truth.
Right, okay. So Video Networks is going to go bust then, isn't it?
You'd have to ask Video Networks about that.
Well, you just said that it doesn't work as a broadcast technology. And that
No, I didn't say that. I said the ADSL network doesn't operate as a broadcast technology. Video Networks has an enhanced ADSL system, which is very expensive to roll out nationally, and we have no current proposal to roll out that out nationally.
Could you make their life easier if you were chivvied along to do so?
Well, we've made their life easier by lowering our prices, and we'll continue to do our best. But, you know, they have to look after themselves. They're grown-up commercial boys, like the rest of the people who use our network.
So speaking of grown-up commercial boys, isn't there an answer to the Channel 4 problem, which would be to privatise it? And isn't that the implicit consequence of this communications bill?
It's the FT's answer to everything.
Well,
of course. No. I mean, you know, yes, it is an answer. I think it's, you might not kill the patient, but it certainly turns it into another animal. And that's not what the bill says it wants. If the bill had said, we don't care about Channel 4, let it go hang, fine, but it doesn't. It says, very, very important, you know, major pillar, lovely thing, does its public corporation, but it's commercially financed. So that's the problem. The government does not want privatisation. I'm extremely glad, personally, it doesn't want privatisation. But it is going to make life, you know, I don't think it's intended it. I think it's a funny way. I've been around doing this kind of thing rather too long. In the 1990 Act period, what was very evident was that people took ITV for granted. Mm. Well, we've seen the mistake of doing that. Mm. I think they're doing the same thing now with Channel 4. And unfortunately could have the same sort of consequence. There are other answers, but the one I've put in here is, I think, you know, very precise. Mm. If you don't allow Sky to take over Channel 5, that helps a lot. Doesn't solve it, but it's more livable with. Allowing Sky to take over Channel 5 would accelerate the process of problem for Channel 4 rapidly.
But politically, Barry, surely that's very unlikely to happen, that they now, having had, with such fanfare, announced that Sky would be allowed to own Channel 5, that they then turn around and in the meantime you look at Channel 4 and you say, well, it spent a lot of money on its own businesses, probably wasted a lot of money on those businesses, it's commissioning, its acquisitions policy is also questioning the whole idea of Channel 4 and the principle that when we or others suggest Channel 4 could be privatised, the argument that's always raised to us is, well, if Channel 4 were privatised, it would become another animal, it would be much harder to deliver on the remit. I don't understand why. I thought the whole principle of this bill was that it doesn't matter who owns a broadcaster, we can regulate for content, for diversity, for quality, for plurality, and that's something that Channel 4 could live with even if it was in private ownership.
But if it makes no difference, why privatise it?
Because they can't afford to compete. Ways. They can't afford to compete.
And why does privatising help that?
Well, because then Chris and his friends at Disney could buy it and they might have bigger pockets and be able to spend more money.
And you don't think that would change the nature of Channel 4? Come on.
I mean, the point that you're not taking is that what they're proposing for 3 and 5 is consistent with a very limited and achievable public service remit. You know, to say to whoever owns Channel 3 and Channel 5 that you've got to make original production in significant numbers, they want to do that. You know, they would like to have the money to do it. It's a virtuous circle. You do this sort of thing, you get better audiences. Mm. So they will do it. Having a quality news service, yeah, that's a bit of an imposition, but not an undoable one. So what is proposed for the commercial public service broadcasters is coherent and consistent.
Channel 4's public service remit is best achieved through a public corporation because it is about risk-taking, it's about innovation, it's about a particular creative culture, and frankly, having lived in a commercial one and a public corporation one, I can tell you it's a lot easier to do in a public corporation than it is in a commercial one. That's, you know, that's life at the moment. Whether Channel 4 can carry on doing it in the longer term, we'll see.
I'd like to turn to Phil. One question. Can you explain then what do you think when it comes to radio, what would be a better way of doing things than 3+1?
Well, the radio industry and the radio operators and the regulator came up with 3+1 as the best compromise between the various constraints that we wanted to operate under. There was a great deal of argument at the time within commercial radio that we should simply go to competition rule and have local ownership essentially settled by the competition authorities, which, as Christopher said, are, you know, the last guardian of consumer interest. Now, that's one alternative view, and I think there are merits in looking at that, given the essentially similar nature of the regulation on ownership as it seems to be being applied to the other media. We have the situation where Channel 3 and Channel 5 could be under common ownership. Now, clearly the Competition Commission would have a great deal to say about that, and one struggles to see a set of circumstances under which that might occur. But it is one possible alternative. There are other alternatives, which is to one of which is to amend the points, the local point system, which has currently been created, to maybe allow 2+ the BBC. And one of the arguments, and I'm not suggesting this is my personal view, because as I say, radio is a very diverse, fragmented industry. But one of the arguments is that radio seems to be carrying plurality at a local level. Yet the documentation itself states that it's the Channel 3 licensee and local newspapers that are the most important media at a local level. So there seems to be, again, an illogicality in suggesting that radio has to carry the local plurality when, by implication, it's the least important local medium. Now, I don't happen to believe that, but it's what it says in the bill, in the draft.
Thank you. We haven't really addressed this, the internet question, the question of internet regulation. I just wondered, Professor Mansell, whether in your travels you've seen anywhere that does it better than is suggested in this bill.
I wish I had a good answer to that question. I was not saying that one has to regulate the internet. I want to make that clear. I think the internet, in many senses, is unregulable. What I was saying was that there is a lot going on that involves protocols of the internet that is accessed via the platforms that we're talking about regulating. And therefore, the nature of the regulation that is being put in place will help to shape which services are available, what investors see as a good thing to do, will help to shape the pricing structures, etc. And so when you ask me where are they doing it right, I would say that this is a fast-moving young market, and you can't just look to another country and say, where are they doing it right? The circumstances are different. The maturity of the market is different. The players are different. The constellation of them are different. What I am saying is that if the legislation itself, by definition, says that services available for reception by members of the general public are going to be defined from the outset to exclude two-way services and a whole lot of one-to-one services, then we're thinking about an environment which is fairly soon going to disappear, and we ought to recognize that up front and realize that in many ways this legislation may be being too tightly ring-fenced around what we understand to be the conventional services of today. We know what a telephone service is. We know what the broadcast free-to-air services are. We know what digital television was, or maybe will be. The point I'm making is we almost seem to be thinking about history in terms of this legislation. And that's very concerning. The market is moving tremendously quickly. So what I think I'm suggesting is we need a shift so that the discussion and the words that are used in the legislation reflect more of the reality that is just around the corner. And I think Britain, by virtue of throwing all of this up in the air, has a golden opportunity to get it right, possibly before other countries do. And that's a special opportunity. which we welcome.
Thank you. Before I reach the floor, I had one final question for Sir Christopher, which was, if you were changed jobs today and you were, another call denied. If you changed jobs today, let's say you were to run, Granada, for example.
Yes, that'd be nice. I accept that offer.
Okay. If you were to run Granada...
Do I get to sack Charles Allen?
I wondered, how would you feel about the way in which this bill and the government is treating the BBC?
Well, I'd like to think I would feel the same as I do now and the same as I did when I was chairman of the BBC. I think that the BBC is part of Ofcom. It comes under the Ofcom remit. And the only part that doesn't is the BBC's responsibility for content. And that's critical. And the reason it's critical is that's what the BBC exists to do. The BBC is different from BT or an ITV company. They have commercial objectives, and their primary role, believe it or not, is to make money for their shareholders. That's not what the BBC is for. And to take the responsibility for delivering that primary role away from the group of people who are allegedly in charge of it is quite simply an organisational nonsense. So you shouldn't do it, and I'm delighted that the government isn't doing it, at least at the moment.
And what do you think is the government's vision for the BBC?
Well, you'd have to ask the government that. But the other reason I'd also feel keen, and it was very interesting that Phil was saying, let's not worry about the BBC, there are more important things to do, is that the commercial companies will not benefit if they are part of the same content regulatory regime as the BBC, because the whole tendency towards ITV and the radio companies ought to be lighter touch regulation. By definition, the BBC's regulatory regime has to be, in contrast, much heavier. And to mix those two will pull it inevitably towards the heavy side, and that won't be in the interest of the ITV company.
Right. So do you think if under the new rules, Ofcom would oversee... Ofcom would take a view on the introduction of something like BBC Three?
I do telephones now. I've talked enough about the BBC.
If anyone would like to ask Sir Christopher a question about the BBC, all the best of luck. We've got a great collection of people here. I'm really interested to hear either thoughts or questions. The one issue, of course, is if you could keep them sort of brief and concise. I don't want to sort of invite particular people to speak, but I may yet be tempted. So who would like to start off? And please feel free. We see you up there. Well, I'm sorry, it's going to have to come to this. Richard. Hooper. Of the Radio Authority. I wondered what you thought the next 3 months are going to bring in terms of how far we'll travel from the government's proposals on the communications bill to what we'll actually end up seeing in terms of ownership regulations in radio.
I think you'll find that the government will not change its mind on 3+1 for the simple reason that, and it's a fundamental truth underlying Ofcom, competition and market forces by themselves do not yield the public interest in broadcasting. Full stop. And if you want experience of it, you go to New Zealand, Australia, United States of America. There are competition roles in broadcasting, but essentially there are issues in broadcasting where competition does not deliver the public interest. Let me give you one example. Phil's company is based entirely on advertising. Advertisers are basically interested in 15 to 44-year-olds, maybe 54-year-olds. But the heartland is 15, 25, 35. Thus, how can competition yield the public interest if the major funding power behind broadcasting free-to-air is the advertiser who is not interested in people over the age of 44 or 54? So that is absolutely central to the debate.
Thank you. For any questions?
Hello.
Could you do the mic?
Sorry.
This is a question and a comment. I've spent the last 24 hours in Brussels being briefed by many people in the Commission, many people in the Parliament, about the significance of the telecoms package, which is being brought forward in the new EU regulatory framework next summer in 2003, which, if the Communications Bill is introduced in the Queen's speech, will probably run parallel in terms of the process. Why is it that nothing that is said in terms of the commentary that we've heard this evening, and so little attention is given to that European framework, particularly on telecoms? Because it seems to me that when Sir Christopher talks about the need for a continually robust relationship with Ofcom, it's probably going to have to be even more robust with Brussels.
Could I just observe that one of the most delicate, perhaps, issues in the new European package is the changing way of defining significant market power. And given the heterogeneity of the kinds of services that BT will be involved in providing, it seems to me that you're absolutely right to say that in the interpretation in London through Ofcom of how to define significant market power and how it's seen in Brussels could have enormous implications for the way the regional market develops and indeed how BT is situated with regard to its counterparts in Europe.
And we're right in thinking that the European directive will take precedence over the views of Ofcom, is that right?
Yes, it will.
Sorry, there was a question just up here. So will you introduce yourself?
Yes, hi, I'm Paul Longhurst. I'm from the Allman Partnership, which is a media buying company. I'd like to push, if I may, a bit further on points that Barry Cox made, specific to Channel 4. And that, you know, Channel 4 is a fantastic success story in that it's fantastically successful from a viewing public point of view, and it's also fantastically successful from a commercial advertising point of view. And I think that, you know, with an advertising industry hat on, we want to do as much as we possibly can to protect that situation where you get literally the best of both worlds. So the question really was, if, and I guess really what Barry's saying here is that he needs within this finally some protection against what seems to be the obvious outcome. If Channel 4 does not get that protection, A, what do we think is going to happen? And B, is there anything that the advertising industry can do to kind of lobby to help maintain not just the remit, but the commercial viability of Channel 4 to move forward and to progress even more?
Yes, of course.
Well, I'm afraid you're right. It is an unfortunate truth that one has to use the word protection. And but that is actually what terrestrial broadcasting still is. It is protected. It's protected because very few people get their hands on it. And that's why we've got an effective multiple public service system in this country. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for the government, as I've said, to revise that view and revise downwards, if you like, the expectations of 3 and 5, and what it's doing is, in their terms, fine. But it does leave Channel 4 unprotected. I hope I'm not overstating this. But the short answer to your question is, please lobby on the 2020 rule for Channel 5.
So there's a question over here. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jake Lynch. I work as a reporter for BBC News, but also I help to run Reporting the World, which is a service for journalists, bringing journalists together to discuss ethical issues in international news. So I suppose I represent a bit of an imposition, in Barry Cox's words, on these go-ahead companies. My question is this, really, and it has to do with the Content Board and the interesting comments by Professor Mansell. The history of the last few years, in terms of the development of new services on commercial terrestrial television channels, has been a bit of a sad and sorry tale. And that's something which concerns us in all sectors of the industry because we all benchmark to a certain extent off each other. Now, I was very attracted recently by the comments of Honora O'Neill in her Reith lecture on the news, where she lamented the lack of accessibility in the news. And the question really is this. If the Content Board is to have a robust and vigorous role in updating and projecting notions of public service in the news, and if the provisions of the bill about quality news services are to prove durable or future-proof, to use the jargon, isn't the content board going to have to equip itself or avail itself of specific and transparent criteria for judging whether news services are indeed delivering a quality service and are indeed delivering a public service remit?
Would like to answer.
One of the points that we raised in the one-page little blurby that excuse me, you find in your folder, is that the Tier 2 regulation and the content side of things, which uses objective criteria, supposedly, is open to discussion with the broadcasters and will be negotiated as to which criteria should be applied in which instances. But it doesn't say that the discussions will be held with all stakeholders. And so it seems to me that there is a question as to just exactly how decisions will be made as to whether or not these different organizations are meeting what the common consensus is as to what is public service broadcasting. And that's at the Tier 2 level. At the Tier 3 level, it's even more subjective and open-ended. And I think there needs to be a real obvious mechanism, I guess you could say, or a procedure through which decisions are made. I guess I personally wouldn't advocate that you could actually write that into the legislation, but it needs to be explicit that that procedure needs to take place.
I mean, news is one area where the regulations are tougher than they currently are, because A, the nominated news provider concept is being extended or could be extended to Channel 5, which isn't at the moment. That's a very good thing that that's happening. And secondly, I don't know how important this is, but none of this is in there. Ofcom will have powers about the amount of money spent by Channel 3 and I presume Channel 5 in due course on news, which it doesn't have at the moment. So actually, and I do think this is coherent with what consistent for the government to say this, it's saying we are going to deregulate in all kinds of ways, but this is a public interest. This is very important for citizens. We're going to make it tougher. I'm fine.
There's some questions down here.
Thank you. I'm David Lipsey. I just wanted to ask a general question through genuine puzzlement, really, about what people think is the actual speed of change. Not, I think, in the corporate sense of who owns whom, but in terms of what consumers and customers are actually getting and wanting. And I remember 3 years ago, as a member of the Davis panel, sitting in Christopher and John Burt's office, having digital television demonstrated, and this is the future, it's right at hand. And it seems the occupants of the offices have changed, but much the same shape. I don't go into people's homes and find them replaying different football angles, left, right, and centre. In the same way, I see very little convergence, really, between the internet and what we traditionally thought of as broadcasting. On the other hand, there have been some changes, for example, in the take-up of multi-channel homes, which clearly are significant. And I really wanted to get the panel's view. How quickly is this changing? Because it does affect your attitude to the bill. This is a bill drafted in a way to cope with quite a lot of change, and it does that by giving very broad power to Ofcom. Is that proving necessary, and is it right we should stick with that?
Well, I'll start from radio. I don't think for the traditional FM, AM radio spectrum you will see much change at all. I think most radio companies and the services they provide are governed by formats which will continue into Ofcom. So I don't see... Capital FM will not suddenly become Classic FM overnight or vice versa. I think there are interesting areas. I mean, I think the supposed convergence of broadcast radio and the internet actually has gone in a complete reversal. And there were great hopes 4 or 5 years ago that the delivery of radio via the net was going to be the next big thing. I can tell you as a main board director of a company that spent £5 or £6 million trying to prove that is not going to be the case. But what is interesting is that the increase in choice available via Sky, for example, I think has got some benefit for radio. And in fact, some research published only last week suggested that there were 2.75 million people actively using their Sky set boxes to listen to radio every week. Now, I have a fancy that actually they're listening for very short periods of time, but the fact that 3 million people are using it nonetheless suggests that when more choice is offered to people on radio, they will take it. And that brings us to digital radio, which we hope has not been tarnished with the same brush as digital television, because it's an entirely different concept, one in which the BBC and the commercial sector are at one with a standard technology. But I think it's the case with all of new technologies. It'll take twice as long, it'll cost twice as much as we expected for this thing to take off. But I think we've long said this is the year for digital radio, and I think it will be. And people who are interested in that particular sphere will, I think, be very interested at the rate of introduction of digital sets that's likely to take place during the summer and into the autumn. So, yes, Ofcom and its deregulatory approach to radio will have an effect, but we probably won't see it for the next, for most people, for the next 3 or 4 years.
I think in television terms and internet terms, convergence is plainly coming, but very, very slowly. And I think that the trap that governments tend to fall into is thinking that by wishing things should happen, they can therefore cause them to happen, and that ought to be avoided in the bill and in government's actions. They have very, very limited power to accelerate digital switch-off, and it's no good setting dates and targets and exhorting the various players to do things unless those players are going to do them anyhow. In that case, the exhortations are unnecessary. Digital switch-off is not going to happen within 10 years. And I think everybody, possibly excluding the government, is now clear about that. What the government can do, and have failed to do, is to get their own digital act together in those areas that they control. And if you look in particular at what they could do, and so how far have been very slow to do, in terms of encouraging the e-enabling of educational content and the educational curriculum, it is there that they could really make a difference, because they have the power to do it. You also have the power to do it in local government, in the health service, and they're beginning to realise that. It's in those areas, indirectly but powerfully, that they can affect the future shape of the digital world.
As someone who isn't in the government but does think it can,
Barry,
can,
that's not what
can still happen. it can still happen, because, you know, 2010 is 8 years away. And one of the my answer to David Lipsy is that it's wonderfully unpredictable. I mean, the one of the sublime ironies of the current situation is that 3 years ago, when the government said we're all going to go digital, since that point, the analog TV market, which was floundering and no one was making any money, has taken off, and there are now something like 50% more analog sets around than there were. 50% more are being bought each year than there were in 1998. The reason for that is DVD. And what happened is, and again, you know, you talk to Sony and they will tell you this is absurd. This is an expensive technology. It's not recordable. What, you know, why on earth is anybody going to buy this thing? Well, so much for the manufacturer's foresight. They bought it because they decided they liked the quality of DVD. And if you like the quality of DVD, then actually a widescreen, big, expensive set is what you need to watch it on. And so suddenly Sony and others are the beneficiaries of this entirely unintended and unplanned event, which cuts against the whole digital strategy. Well, it probably doesn't in the end. And, you know, no one saw it coming. The consumer said, we like this. And so, thank God, the manufacturers responded. And I'm afraid that's the way it will be, David. You know, we will go along and something else will come up. Mobile video will happen. Nokia are looking at something, I understand, which is a cross between a mobile phone and a TV set, which you will carry around with you. And the problem with mobile phones, even third generation, and I understand why Christopher got out of it, is that if you tried to send live the World Cup goals, it will crash. 3,000 people do it, and the system's down. Broadcast can do it, as many as you want, and Nokia have spotted that, and they will offer you what is effectively a broadcast to a mobile phone. And that is the sort of thing that will happen, and we can't predict what that will do to the speed of change. It'll do something.
course, I should just point out that it's DAB is the technology that will deliver that rather than DVB, because DAB is the only one that's designed to be used in a mobile environment. Plug for DAB there.
Yes. Can I just point out that what seems very remarkable is that we lurch from absolute certainty to absolute uncertainty in seconds. 1 minute, Sir Christopher is explaining to us how rapidly the demand for ASDL will be taken up, although that's not the most revolutionary of technologies, been around for a while. But we're certain demand curve will look more or less like this. And the next minute, we have no certainty because we haven't any idea what users will actually do when they get access to that little green modem that's available to consumers in their houses.
Well, we have a bit of an idea. The idea is roughly 12,000 a week at the moment and rising. Not a bad idea. Gets you, you know, on that curve to 1 million by the middle of next year. Bit of an idea.
We have a cluster of questions here and some people up here, so can have a question here and then up and back down.
Professor Grout from the University of Bristol. I have what is a comment and a question to the panel. A central part of the policy is that we need light-handed regulation with a constant competition law applied across the piece, because we don't want regulation to inform the direction forward, since we have no idea ourselves how the markets are moving. That's a central concept behind Ofcom. But if we actually look at Oftel, where British Telecom were privatised almost 20 years ago, it's been 10 years since the liberalisation review, we've still got masses of what we would think of as ex-ante regulation, price controls. There's been very little rolling back of that direct regulation that we've expected. And I think you can make a very powerful case that actually a lot of that regulation has been exported into the Competition Act through the sector-specific guidelines. There is therefore a real fear that what could happen in this industry, and I think there's already some signs of it, that you'll actually just get more and more of this direct interventionist ex-ante regulation, possibly even the competition law being interpreted in manners that actually have exported this. And there doesn't seem to be a lot anywhere in the bill that seems to somehow prevent that and ensure that we do get indeed the light-handed regulation model that is essential. There are a few small things we can do, like scrapping sector-specific guidelines would be a perfect thing to do. And I just wondered if the panel have any view of how we assure we get into the right box and don't go off into the other box, because as Oftel themselves often say, it's no fun having nothing to regulate, and that might be one of the reasons regulation doesn't go away very quickly.
I agree.
there is an obligation on Ofcom to review its regulation with the purpose of getting out of areas where it's, so I mean that's a pretty important primary objective. So I don't know whether you're right about your, I don't mean your ex ante men, I'm afraid, but
no,
that's all right. I ought to know. Yeah, well, it's a very good idea. No, I'm all in favour of that. Stop the bastards getting on. But I do think that the bill is structured to head in the direction. Whether human nature will allow it is another question. But I do think they've thought about that, the people, you know, when in writing the bill.
So, question up here.
Hello, my name is Nigel Ormond. I'm from the Ormond Partnership and Media Buying Company. With regard to programme production, which clearly the creation of content is a fundamental part of what we're trying to protect and nurture, does the panel think that the 25% quota for independent producers in place is a good thing, and should it be extended to, say, 40 or 50%?
Can I just say, as a main board director of a company that has a suite of independent producers, 50% sounds fine by me, but I'm not sure that's going to happen. But I do think that the 25% rule, as it's been applied, has nurtured a fantastic independent production sector, and we would lose that at our peril. And I think that going forward has got to be a tremendous thing. And I say that not just out of self-interest, but because I do think that the ability to have a range of different companies producing programmes has been beneficial for the TV industry in this country.
Actually, I think you're probably right. Tim Gardam is exercised about this and believes that it should go up to 33% or something, largely because it's the, as Phil says, it's a very effective creative sector. Arguably, or don't for God's sake test me on it in detail, produce some of the best stuff that we've got on television. And it is possibly in danger of stagnating with a few big suppliers and lots of little cottage firms. And it may well need a new lease of life to keep the thing vigorous and doing what it's done for the last 20-odd years or however long it's been going. So, yes, in principle, I think you're right.
Thank you. So, question in the middle here. Thanks.
Simon Olswang. I'd like to go back to David Lipsy's question and the answers. I am always enormously attracted to this industry because of its unpredictability. And I confess that I was rather relieved that this bill didn't attempt to do what governments often try to do, which is anticipate change, sometimes with disastrous results. So I wanted to ask Professor Mansell, who's expressed some regret that the bill didn't deal with internet and two-way and the like, what she might have liked to see in the bill that isn't there now.
I think I, specifically with regard to the services which are deemed to be within the remit of Ofcom, I think that there should be an attempt to include those services which enable access to internet content to be at least considered as being within the remit, and that should be something which is necessary, because at least some organizations like the Internet Watch organization would say that the ISPs simply aren't going to self-regulate. And so in that sense, for the protection of children and citizens in general, it seems to me that the net shouldn't be drawn as closely as it has been, at least in my understanding of what they're going to mean by electronic communication services, which are available for delivery to all of the public.
Oh, sorry, there's a gentleman right at the back. Oh, you can do either one. And we'll come to you in a minute. Thanks.
Brian Haley. The question that I'd like to ask touches upon two particular areas: the powers of the regulator to look after the interests of the consumer and also assist the government in terms of its economic policy. Now, the Culture and Sport and Media Select Committee recently made some suggestions to what the regulator may consider in terms of BT and divesting BT in terms of its network. Two aspects of the economic strategy of the government is the knowledge and digital economy. So the question is this: how does the divesting of the BT network help deliver the digital and knowledge economy, and at the same time prevent a north-south economy being generated as a consequence?
Well, it doesn't. And that's why BT don't think the separation of its retail and wholesale sides makes any sense, either economic or from the point of view of the consumer. If you want to give BT 2 years of economic disruption, organizational confusion, and make a lot of merchant bankers rich, then it's a very attractive recommendation. But the fact that the Select Committee for Culture, Media and Sport suggested it, that's a committee much loved by both me and my fellow licensed fee payer Chris Smith, is one of the most powerful recommendations in favor of ignoring it.
Thanks very much. There's a question in it. Someone in the middle.
Thanks, Steve Barnett. I've got two questions that haven't been raised yet. The first is that this whole issue of opening up I'm talking about broadcasting now, opening it all up to American investors. And I'm intrigued that we've heard the magic two words, inward investment, as a justification for this policy. And I can entirely see the logic for inward investment when we're talking about opening Nissan plants in Sunderland, creating jobs, creating a product for which there is a template and can be sold worldwide. What are the implications for companies like Viacom or Walt Disney coming in and investing money in this country, who clearly will want to do more than simply tap the UK commercial advertising market, because otherwise why not leave it to Granada or Carlton or Sky, and will be surely more tempted to make a kind of mid-Atlantic type of program and try and push out the boundaries of what might be defined as local programming. That's my first question. What are the risks of inward investment? The second is, coming back to Barry's point about Sky, I think there is a real issue about Murdoch and News International, currently owning over 30% of the newspaper market, currently owning 80% of the pay TV platform, now being allowed to own Channel 5 and potentially turn it into the most popular commercial television channel, the most popular channel in this country. Given all that, isn't there also a logic to obliging BSkyB to divest itself either of the control of its pay TV platform or its content? In other words, it's the whole issue of separating content from platform control in the pay television market.
Barry, do you want to start on foreign ownership?
I'm not as pessimistic as you, Steve, about this. I regret to say, I think the strategic reason the government did this was because it had rather given up on the idea that there were any British owners around who could keep commercial public service broadcasting as a significant force between Sky and the BBC. And that actually this is an attempt to do that, because I don't think it's in the interest of any of us if broadcasting is essentially split between BBC and Sky. As to whether that ownership would have the kind of mid-Atlantic consequence you say, well, it might, but I think I understand. I think Greg Dyke repeated the other day. The experience seems to be that indigenous broadcasting does better. I mean, CNN have had to do that in the provision of news. They've had to go local, or go regional anyway. And I actually think, you know, these are smart companies. They will want to just do a service that the people of Britain want to watch. And actually that probably means, particularly if it's underpinned by a requirement for a substantial amount of original production, that we will get predominantly British programmes. So I may be being Pollyanna-ish here, but I do think that's more likely than the outcome you're describing or you're worrying about.
I just want to ask you, Christopher, do you think the same thing, in that actually a foreign owner, let's say it were a Viacom that was owning a terrestrial broadcaster, would actually serve the audience rather than their back catalogue?
Yes, I think they would, for the reasons that Barry has suggested. But I think there are unpredictable dangers. Dangers may be the wrong word, but unpredictable changes to the broadcasting landscape if Channel 5 is allowed to be taken over. And I'm not sure you should stop that, but those of you who can remember what Rupert Murdoch did when he bought The Sun very cheaply and changed it from a paper with a circulation of about 30,000 within about 3 or 4 years and bought it very cheap, shouldn't underestimate the ability of any serious populist television broadcaster changing Channel 5, because it is, after all, a unified national channel in a way that ITV is not yet and won't be for some time, into the most dominant terrestrial broadcaster in the United Kingdom. Now, that's not impossible. It would require a lot of money, a lot of creative judgment, and a lot of nerve. And if you want it to happen, then the framework is there for it to happen. Whether it will or not, less predictable. But that it could is plainly the case, I think.
To respond to the risk issue, it seems to me that probably what one needs to be concerned about is whether or not, in attracting the foreign investors from wherever they hail from, you get a particular combination of foreign investment and market consolidation which is seen to be good for everyone, as it says. And it's that joint working of two phenomenon going on that creates the incentives for what gets produced and what doesn't, and the balance between global programming, globally oriented programming, and local production. And investors saying, well, we can't actually make this market work unless we do tailor our product for the local market. And studies show around the world, audiences seem to be different. In some cases, the onslaught of American programming has been something which has overtaken, and people watch very little of their homegrown programming, my country in particular, which is Canada. But in other countries, for reasons which we have yet really to understand fully, you can have awful lot of imported programming and foreign investors, and people still are attracted to their indigenous kinds of content. So there's a research question there, fortunately, for academics. But for investors and for the legislators, I think my view is that we may be rolling back just a little too quickly to let, and we're assuming those investors are going to come and that they're actually going to do the kinds of things which would be valued in terms of the plurality and diversity of programming. I'm not sure that's a safe assumption myself. So that's a risk.
And sorry, is the implication of that that it's easier to regulate proprietors who live in the country you're regulating, and they get better regulated, and the service they provide is better for society?
Well, place of establishment of an organization matters, it seems to me, and the business and the employees who are located in a country are the ones that are going to be doing the arguing with the regulator. It seems to me that we wouldn't expect, despite virtuality, that any company investing would not have a physical presence in the land in which it's offering services. So it seems to me that it's not a black and white issue. It may be more difficult, but one has to see.
I have just two more questions.
Peter Ibbotson, Jim Ford, Professor Manns.
The document that comes with the draft bill makes it perfectly plain that the government does not intend to introduce regulation on internet content. Is your position that you think there should be some specific form of regulation for this? And if so, why do you feel that the internet should be subject to degrees of regulation beyond the laws of the land that do not apply in print, which is also a many-to-many form of communication? And as a sort of subtext to that, is that the real problem with internet, the identification of a publisher rather than the availability of laws to deal with what is published?
I knew I was going to get into trouble for taking the position I did. Thank you for the question. Let me try to be slightly more clear than I was before. The internet is a term that we throw around a great deal as if it was a thing that you go and you regulate. It's a set of protocols. It's a means of accessing content. Some of that content is, like pornographic content, already something which is illegal under the law, and therefore, if self-regulation works in order to take care of that problem, I have no problem with that. I'm not saying we need another regulator. It seems to me there are areas in which we know so little really about how people interact with the content of the internet that there needs to be at least some scrutiny and oversight of how the platforms which are using the internet protocol, which enable people to access this, how they're operating. Who owns them? How are they structured? What are the pricing regimes? Are there new foreseeable bottlenecks in the future? The answer to that question may be no at the present, but my position is it should be asked and answered. And my understanding is that by excluding all of the two-way services and most of the one-way ones, the question won't be asked and therefore it won't be answered. I don't want to go on at length. Perhaps we could talk later afterwards, because I think the question you raise about content itself, the press, the freedom of the press, rights of authorship, etc., are very valid ones. And it would be far from anything that I would want to suggest is that we want to get into actually saying in some very draconian way, this may be publishable and this may not be.
One final question, and I'll ask Chris to come and speak.
It's Petros Iosifidis from City University. I would like to ask the panel's views on the wider implications of the bill on European communications industry. I mean, Britain has in some cases in the past initiated regulation and then followed by other European countries, so paved the way for changes in the communications industry. And my question is whether you think that this bill will set the pattern for two really issues, really. First, for more deregulatory move throughout Europe, across Europe, the so-called light touch regulation. And secondly, on converging regulation at an institutional level, whether we should expect to see more Ofcoms created, similar Ofcoms created across Europe. Thank you.
Well, just to go back to the American issue from overseas from a radio perspective, of course I employ a breakfast host in London who's desperate for an Australian company to own it so he can have work here and back home. I think even more in radio than television, it's local or it's going to die. And local, by local I mean either local to a town or city or local to a country. I think it's just simply inconceivable that radio in the UK would somehow become mid-Atlantic because our owners were Viacom or Clear Channel rather than Chrysalis or Capital. I just can't see anybody who runs a radio broadcast operation doing anything other than attempting to serve their locality as well as they possibly can. I don't think there's any mileage in doing anything else. But I do agree that I think there's there will be a big issue for Ofcom if it turns out that they're having to deal with companies whose head offices are thousands upon thousands of miles away. I think that's just a practical challenge for the regulators, which they may have to deal with in the future. I also happen to think, in radio in particular, that the price of radio assets is so high that we're busy seeing the Americans sell out of radio rather than buy in. So whether they actually want to come back and buy more assets, I don't know. Europe is a different matter, and so far the evidence is very mixed on radio crossing boundaries in Europe, in part because the complexity of the legislation in the individual territories is so it's complex and diverse, and anything that made it simpler would be welcomed, but I have a fancy it won't happen, and I certainly can't envisage a situation where some of the other major European countries envisage the sort of deregulatory and far-reaching ownership rules that are envisaged in this bill.
Thank you. I'm sure other people have questions. There's an opportunity to chat to people afterwards upstairs when we have a drink, but I'd like to ask Chris Smith, who was involved in this process early on, to come and wrap things up for us. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, James. It is an almost impossible task to try and summarise what has been a rather eclectic discussion about a lot of different aspects of the bill. The first observation I would make, however, is that I actually think it's rather good that this platform has happened, because it has brought together to discuss the future of communications regulation, I think for the first time, senior representatives of telecoms and broadcasting and academia and, in terms of broadcasting, both television and radio. And that in itself mirrors, in a way, the whole exercise that the creation of Ofcom is supposed to be about. Perhaps inevitably, of course, the representative from telecoms told us that telecoms had been neglected in the media coverage of the bill. The representative from Channel 4 told us that Channel 4 was in mortal danger and that predatory intentions which are liberated in relation to Channel 5 must be stopped. Academic representative told us that the content board and the consumer panel need to be strengthened and their powers made more specific. And the representative of radio told us that the local ownership rules were out of step with the overall deregulatory climate of the bill. So there was a bit of special pleading going on from all of these. But it strikes me that there's been a broad measure of agreement that most of the bits of the bill are heading in the right direction. But some very interesting issues, I think, began to emerge. The issue about how Ofcom is going to balance the sometimes conflicting responsibilities which the bill gives it. And the bill very specifically says that Ofcom is going to be responsible, firstly, for the promotion of competition, secondly, for the protection of consumers. Actually, the bill rather infelicitously, I think, talks about customers. I'd rather it talked about consumers. Thirdly, that it's there to enhance quality. And fourthly, that it over time has to do itself out of business by encouraging deregulation. And fifthly, that it has to ensure the best use of the spectrum. Now, those objectives are on quite a number of occasions going to come into conflict. And it will be in the nature of the beast with Ofcom that it's going to have to take sensible and judicious balances between those objectives in the public interest. And I think some of the discussion has highlighted some of those areas. That is not a problem that can be put right by the legislation, and it shouldn't be put right by the legislation, because I think it is very important that those balances are in play for the day-to-day work of Ofcom. Secondly, and really as a consequence of that, the bill leaves an awful lot up to Ofcom to decide. And basically it says, here's a parcel, there you, Ofcom, take it, and it's up to you now to handle it. That, again, I think is almost inevitable in this process, particularly if you want a regulatory system that is going to be fleet of foot enough to respond to rapidly changing economic, technological, and public expectation climates. But it does mean that you build uncertainty into the system. But again, that's something that I think we have to live with. Other issues that emerged, there was quite an interesting sort of sub-theme developed in some of the questions and also in some of the things both Christopher and Robin were talking about in relation to the internet. My own view is that you can't and shouldn't try to regulate content on the internet other than the provisions of the law of the land in relation to illegal activity. But, and I think Robin has raised a very interesting point here, as almost inevitably will happen, the provision of one-to-one services across the internet for example, pay-per-view and video-on-demand services, the issues about how those sort of services are regulated, if at all, and the bill at the moment seems to indicate that they won't be because they fall under the provisions of the telecoms part of the bill. They do not fall under the, quote, television-like services, unquote, part of the bill. And therefore, the European directives come into play and no licensing procedure is required. I think that's an area where we need to have some discussion. Because whether we really do want video on demand to be completely unregulated is, I think, something that we need to make some discussion and decisions about. The issue of independent production came up. Actually, the bill is ahead of us here, because where it talks about independent production, it says that Ofcom must set quotas for independent production of at least 25%, must then review those quotas year by year. So it is open to Ofcom to extend the provisions for independent production in future if that becomes appropriate and feasible. There are, I believe, quite a number of areas of discussion that we still need to have about the detail of the bill as it begins to take its shape through the pre-legislative scrutiny and then hopefully in the autumn on the floor of the House. Here, for what it's worth, are my handful of issues that I think need to be looked at. First, the position of the BBC in relation to Tier 3. I don't think it's an issue that you can just park, as has been suggested. The ultimate power, not for day-to-day intervention in what the BBC does, but the ultimate power that at the moment rests in the hands of the Secretary of State, but only in terms of a nuclear weapon, whether that should rest with Ofcom rather than the Secretary of State, I think is an issue that is still up for discussion. And indeed, Gavin Davis has indicated that he is at least prepared to have that debate. The issue of Channel 5, it shouldn't be, I think it's unhelpful to regard it in an ad hominem fashion. A lot of the commenting on the provisions in relation to Channel 5 and ownership have taken an ad hominem approach. I don't think that's helpful, because what you need to do is to think through the consequences of a major investor of any kind coming into Channel 5, turning it into something that is a big player in the overall broadcasting landscape, and the potential impact that that has, not just on Channel 4. I think Channel 4 is actually better off because it's protected to a certain extent by its remit, but the impact on Channel 3, on ITV, potentially is huge, I'm not sure that all the consequences of that have been thought through. I think the issues about telecoms liberalisation and some semi-broadcast type of services across telecoms networks needs to be pinned down. I think there does need to be some discussion on radio. I'm actually intrigued as to why I think I'm right in saying the Radio Authority and the commercial radio companies having come up with a proposal that was for 2+1, certainly some came up with a proposal for 2+1, the government having gone for 3+1, I think that there is a debate to be had between those two alternatives. I think there does need to be a look at the role of the consumer panel and how it operates and how it can comment meaningfully but not dictate, getting its particular role right is important. And finally, in some ways the million-dollar question, how do you ensure quality and choice in content without box ticking? How do you try and maintain editorial standards across the field of public service broadcasting without having a regulator that enters into detailed nitpicking on a regular basis? Everyone, I think, has agreed that we don't want the regular nitpicking and that we want to get away from the box-ticking mentality. How can you construct meaningful ways of self-regulation with an ultimate co-regulatory element to it that makes sense of trying to balance these parts of the conundrum? I think it's possible to do, but I think we need to be very clear about what we're trying to do. Which brings me finally to the rather neat expression that we had, which was that we lurch from absolute certainty to absolute uncertainty in an instant in all of this field. That is absolutely right. We are dealing with uncertainties. We will always be dealing with uncertainties in relation to communications. What you need to do when you're in an area where you are dealing with uncertainties is to get the principles right, get the approach to regulation right, and then you have to say it is up to the sensible regulator to make the judgments case by case on how those are applied to the uncertainties as they arise. I think the bill on the whole does get that basic approach to regulation right. I sense that there is a general agreement about that, but there are, of course, still quite a number of points of detail which remain to be discussed.
Thank you very much. Thank you. All that remains for me to do is to thank Rog Silverstone and our host at the LSE for having us here this this evening. They are such good hosts, in fact, that with the help of Channel 4 and BT, they're inviting us for a drink upstairs on the fifth floor. Professor Mansell has told me that the lifts here do suffer some congestion. You may want to take the stairs after an hour and a half sitting in the lecture hall. Finally, thank you very much to our panelists. Thank you to Chris Smith, to Professor Robin Mansell, to Christopher Bland, Barry Cox, and Phil Riley. Thank you very much.